Patagonia and not have a ride on the old Patagonian Express. 280 miles from Ingeniero Jacobacci on the plains to Esquel in the mountains. The journey takes just under 14 hours, which by my arithmetic means an average of 20 miles per hour. It's a toy train, the gauge is 1 meter, and somehow this train reminds me of how British Railways used to be 50 years ago. Now, that's not surprising, because in fact this line was built by the British. So some nice reminders of the old days linger on, and that's not just in the smell of the train smoke, but in the way the guard comes round and politely touches his cap while he punches your cardboard ticket. Can anybody remember cardboard tickets? In the summer, there are lots of passengers, lots of tourists, but now, in June, in almost midwinter, there are just a few Indians getting off at wayside stops in the middle of nowhere, and me.
This train is Patagonia in a nutshell. A relic from the early years of the century, hanging on by its fingertips. Just like the Patagonians, especially the English and Scots on their lonely sheep farms and the Welsh in their isolated valleys down at the southernmost tip of South America. When times are hard, their instinct is to follow the example of their grandparents and tighten their belts. You might say that times are always hard in Patagonia, but change is just around the corner, and there's beginning to emerge a new breed of pioneer, more worldly, more streetwise, who can see in Patagonia's wide open spaces a new source of wealth.
Patagonia is not only endless plains, cattle and sheep. We have dazzling blue lakes and some of the most spectacular mountains in the world. But our main attraction, touristic attraction, is the Glacier Perito Moreno, and we received every day people from all over the world eager to see the glaciers and to climb our mountains like the Fitzroy or the Torre Mountain.
I've come 20 miles up the shores of Last Hope Sound to where a great yellow limestone cliff rears out of the grasslands beyond, and in that cliff there is a cave. Today, it's the home of just a few birds and perhaps the odd spider. But 25,000 years ago, this was the home of the giant Patagonian sloth, or Milodon. The remains of the Milodon were discovered just before the end of the last century by a German man called Eberhard. And one day he came up from the shores of Last Hope Sound to investigate this cave which overlooked his land. There at the back he found some bits of skin, some bone, and so a rumour spread that perhaps the giant sloth or Milodon was still living here on the Patagonian plains. In fact, the remains had been preserved by the temperature and humidity of the cave, a great disappointment, because had it still been living, the Milodon would have been one of the last living connections with the dinosaurs. Well, the only Milodon in this cave today is a fiberglass replica put here by the Chilean National Parks Department, who run the cave, but it's still a very impressive place to be.
But as more people hear about attractions such as this, there's a danger they'll spoil the very things they come to see. In the Torres del Paine National Park, just up the road from the Milodon Cave, they now get 23,000 visitors a year from North America, Europe, even the Far East. Eduardo Scott used to farm there many years ago. He's also worked as a park ranger.
The rubbish is the problem. And they can't control all that because there are not enough rangers. Yeah? And 4 years ago, a big fire burned 17,000 acres. And that was burning for 2 months. And afterward, it went out by itself because it rained a lot one day, and that did it. There are signs at the entrance of the park, you shouldn't light fire and put out well the fire. But many people don't do that. They just don't care.
When I was there, I was surprised that the entrance fee was so small. I think in British currency it amounted to something like 65 pence to enter one of the world's greatest national parks.
Yes, I always been telling the same thing. But this region, all the money goes to the central, to Santiago, see? And in Santiago, they give so much to each place, and most of the money stays in Santiago. That's why we are fighting now all the time that the region should keep the money here in their own country.
I'm standing in just about the most desolate place I have ever been in my life. I've come now to the northern part of Tierra del Fuego. Behind me is the South Atlantic Ocean, and ahead of me, an area called El Páramo. Páramo means wilderness. The horizon is totally flat, not a house to be seen. In fact, nobody lives within 30 miles of this spot. But 100 years ago, this was the scene of feverish activity, because this was the site of the Tierra del Fuego gold rush. It all started in 1886 when a man called Julio Popper, a man from Romania, arrived in Tierra del Fuego. By all accounts, Popper and his men created a little country here. In fact, at one time, Julio Popper was known as the dictator of Tierra del Fuego. He issued his own coins, gold coins of course, his own stamps, and he was even said to have had an army of men, Popper's army. Well, any gold that was once here has long since been taken away, but there is gold to be found, black gold, because this is part of Tierra del Fuego where oil has been struck.
It's almost surreal, after hundreds of miles of seeing nothing on the plains but sheep, to come across ranks of nodding donkeys, slowly, ponderously sucking oil out of the ground. Perhaps this is Patagonia's future.
This spot, what can you tell me about this spot here?
It's the Amazon Forest.
And where is it?
North of South America.
And what is South America?
It's a continent.
All right. Well, what can you tell me about the Amazon Forest?
For the British in Patagonia, adjusting to change hasn't always been easy. Their social clubs have closed one by one, and though the British schools are still thriving, their main income nowadays comes from teaching English to Latin American children.
A lot of birds. Birds, that's a difficult sound for us. A lot of birds, yes? And what about the flowers?
I came here to Punta Arenas when I was about 3 years old. I went to start to go to school when I was about six, and I went to the same school where I'm teaching now, British school, which was then called St. James College. And we had about 150 pupils then at that time. There's few Britishers here now, you know. I think that first we had perhaps 200 years ago, but now I think there might be who are real Scotch or British, perhaps there's six or seven or eight people, no more. You don't see many of them now.
The Britishers or British descent are really more, what would I say, more united, I suppose, because there is so little of them left.
There's a lot of intermarrying, and then you get boys and girls with British names, and they hardly speak any English. It's nearly all Spanish.
For the Anglo-Argentines, it all came to a head in 1982 when the impossible happened. Argentina invaded the Falkland Islands.
Of course, my mother was very, very pro-British, and although she was very kind and she insisted on us all learning Spanish very well and integrating into the country, but sort of in her heart, she was very much rule Britannia. But you must remember the background of this. Argentines are taught from the time that they are very, very small that the Malvinas are Argentine, so we never doubt the point. Those islands had been robbed from us sort of over 100 years ago, and of course we wanted them back. But then gradually, when they realized that Britain was preparing to fight, and more than I think even the worst part was that they all thought that United States wasn't going to come into the war. So of course, after that time, it became really ridiculous to enormous world powers with all their experience, all their capital and money and armies and technology, fighting a little nation like the Argentines was so ridiculous that, well, really, we thought naturally that somebody was going to try and work out some kind of peace. But just then, unfortunately, the Belgrano was sunk, and that had a terrible impact because it was, we thought it was a very ruthless thing to do. The Belgrano wasn't even in the area of where they were fighting, and it killed sort of hundreds of young boys who were just doing the military service and were learning and that kind of thing. And the feeling against the British at that time was very, very bad, and everybody wanted to fight whatever the circumstances.
All our friends around the Estancia always made a point of making us feel that it had nothing to do with us as, you know, as English-speaking Argentines. But then there was a demonstration in the village, and we're never sure who actually led it. It was quite a big mob, and they went round the plaza in the village chanting, "We've taken over the Malvinas, now let's take over the Madroño," which is our Estancia. And they were about to come over and, you know, and I don't know what they were going to do. But they were stopped. You know, any British property had to be registered and it was going to be expropriated, but of course we're all born here. The police used to come round again and again and again, and my father would say, "Listen, I was born here, my father's born here, my great-grandfather's born here, my children are born here, my grandchildren are born here. The Dunn family is Argentine."
The force who really did any effective fighting was the Air Force. And the planes, yes, you could see them here from the living room window. You could see how many left and how many came back. And I mean, the fact that we were able to sink one or two ships or something like that was really fantastic. You know, in the circumstances, the fact that somebody had sunk a British ship was really something to celebrate, you know, and to admire, because we never thought we could do it. And there'd be movement in the airport day and night, because it wasn't only the fighters that were leaving, it was also these famous Hercules that were used as transport. These really, when you look at it, it was something really heroic, because they used to fly about 6 meters from the waterline because they didn't want to be detected by radars.
Well, it made maybe ill feeling between families, no? Because when you're born British and you've got the British blood, you always pull to your mothers, and then you're an Argentine, and then part of your family's Argentine. That's what affected me. Yes, because you, my children, my grandchildren, my great-grandchildren are all Argentines. And naturally you think about them, because my grandson, well, he was just on the verge of going to Roddy. He was doing his military service at the time. And he got very ill, he got hepatitis, and they had to bring him home. If not, they were the next ones on the list to go to the Malvinas. Because I was living in the camp at the time. And then I came down, I came to San Julian, and that's just when Bob, my brother, was very ill. That's when I stayed here to look after him. And that's when they still had the blackout. I used to have to go around here and put up my curtains at night. But he wouldn't. He wouldn't put them. I'm not in his room, not for anything.
So in all schools and in all places and continuously on the radio and TV, we were given instructions what to do in the case of a bombing, how to work the blackouts. We had blackout practices almost every night. Cars used to go around with a very small little light, so the best thing you could do at night was stay in unless you really had to go out. Because once the British invasion forces were getting near to the islands, it was suggested that they might attack Rio Gallegos because they knew that the airport was here, quite near. It's on about 4 or 5 miles from the city. And, well, it was, we lived in that atmosphere. We didn't know. There were several false alarms, once when a gas tube exploded in a house and everybody thought the bombing had started, and cases like that.
But this business of the war, the Falklands, well, I think that was a mistake. That should never have been. But in my day, my husband never even mentioned that the Falklands was Argentine. Well, you see, it's very difficult to say. We're very Argentine, and I must admit, because I admire the country, I'm very fond of the Argentine, I'm very fond of the Argentine. Bueno. But I said, oh, well, they've got it, just give it to them and be finished with it. Why cause all this disturbance? But I remember afterwards, the person came to visit me, he was French descent. I said, no, he said, you wouldn't like somebody to come into your house and take your tools, would you? You defend it, wouldn't you? I said, yes, of course I would. He will then. So, there you are.
I tell you, it is a cultural question. No? Everybody has been told over and over again that the islands are ours, and the people sort of feel that very, very deeply. Really, I think the world is moving to more pragmatic things, because just look at all the changes that have been taking place in Europe, things that perhaps a year ago would have been unthinkable. Anyway, I think that there are a lot more important things to worry about than the Falkland Islands, or Malvinas, as we call them.
The high point of the Patagonian summer is the local rodeo. The gauchos, South America's answer to cowboys, come in from miles around to show off their horsemanship. The displays can get really complicated, with horses and cattle charging at high speed round the ring. It all harks back to the skills needed in the pioneering days, when Patagonia was being opened up on horseback. The stamina of the gauchos was, and still is, legendary. And even today, the best way to see Patagonia is from the saddle. I joined a party from Huechahue, a cattle farm on the edge of the Andes, which also offers riding holidays in Patagonia's famous Lake District.
There's nothing more peaceful in the world than riding along across the moors on a summer's day. And when I say moors, I mean that because in many ways, this part of Patagonia is like the moors of northern Britain. A bit drier, you don't get the rainfall here, and so you don't get the bogs. And the vegetation is of a cactusy, thorny type as well. But the rolling landscape, the blue sky above, the snow-capped mountains on the western horizon forming the main cordillera of the Andes, this is what Patagonia is about.
Well, this is a very, very old side saddle that women used, or I should say about at least 60 or 70 years ago. This saddle's probably 100 years old, this side saddle. But most of these were imported from England, I think, or from the United States, I suppose. And what else can I show you?
Let's move over and have a look at some of the other saddles. These look more modern. What about this one?
This is the original cowboy saddle, which the cowboys use in the States, and it's used quite a lot here by the farmers of English descent. They like the old cowboy saddle, but not our natives. They don't use this type of saddle.
Well, we're now in the ironmongery department. This great cross of iron is something the like of which I've never seen in my life before. What is this?
This is what we call an asador. It's used for cooking sheep, but it's the only thing they use on the camp because they take this out on horseback when they're gathering the sheep, and you can cook a whole lamb on it, because there's generally 10 or 12 people out gathering sheep. You make a big fire, which amuses people. You make a very big fire, and then you wait till the fire's practically sort of, there's no flames, and then you put it over the embers and let it cook very slowly. And it's very, very good. You should try it.
Well, we've arrived at a place called Playa Bonita, and this is our lunch stop for today. Playa Bonita means beautiful beach, and I can't imagine a better name for a beach looking out upon a bright blue lake across to forested hillsides on the other side leading up to snow-capped mountains above. Everybody's pretty hungry. We've been riding through the morning. It's now 2:30 in the afternoon, and I think they're more than ready for the asado.
Is this well-cooked, Tony?
No, the well-cooked one is this one.
I want well-cooked too. Oh. They all three want well-cooked.
They're all well-cooked.
Right, that's all right then, no problem. Let's give the gentleman a silver knife.
Brilliant, thank you very much. Here we go, wine, beef, bread, or toast I should say. The typical Argentine asado.
I'm sorry to have to say that most of the forest has been burnt, which is a tragedy. We'll have to change the way we manage land here, or we'll convert this also into a desert. That's the worst part of it.
Some people put that down to overgrazing. Others put it down to the changing climate. What do you think the answer is?
Well, I believe we are doing a lot to change the climate by burning off the vegetation here. We've suffered very heavily from fires. Fires that have been started, we never know how they start. But we have a certain theory about it, that it's done purposely. That is the main cause of the drought which we suffer. There is no vegetation, so when it rains or when it snows, that water just disappears down the rivers. And one thing I would like to see here are beavers damming the rivers, which would not allow the best soil to be washed away into the ocean.
The lagoons have dried up, and the winds in Patagonia dries very, very dry. I mean, dry up all the rain doesn't seem to be enough for the ground, for the sufficient. But Patagonia in general, it doesn't matter where it is, it's gone down. As I say to you, we have to get the snow, I think. That's what's needed. But what is my argument now? The sheep today on all the farms are much more refined. Now, before, the animals were different. They didn't have so much wool. The legs were bare, as they're saying. And, they were able to go through the snow. And they probably would not stand up to a very bad winter. That's my opinion.
As young, I was 14, I used to bring the troop of horses for the shepherds every morning. So I now know how cold it used to be. And every year, less snow, less snow, less snow, up to the 40s, 43 onwards.
So this changing climate has been going on for at least, 50 years?
50 years, yes.
Always getting warmer and drier?
Warmer and drier. Now we get rain down here for many years, but no snow. All that rain that falls now used to be snow.
Have you any ideas, any theories as to why this change is happening?
Well, I think the scientific give me the answer to that, you know, with the ozone all this pollution and all that.
Ah, the ozone layer.
The ozone layer, yeah.
Well, that's certainly the favourite theory at the moment, isn't it? But
so, yeah,
I'm
it.
Very interested to hear that the change has been going on for 50 years.
Well, you know, the ozone, it started very small. So that's why, as it's going bigger, the change, the weather bound to be like that. Hmm? Now it's a big hole in the ozone, so it's more change of weather.
Oh, my dear, the snow, let me see, that used to be, a meter or more than a meter. But in my day, we seemed to be all, we had enough to carry on, or we just, you know what I mean? Because when you're young, well, you look at life different too, so when you're older, and it's, aren't you? Yeah. And now, I can't complain now, because here I am, as you see me. Well, I have my cubilación, as we call it, my pension, my, you know, my... No, what do you call it? Pension in
English? We say pension, yes.
Pension. Yes, I've got that, but that's sort of a regalo. That's my sueldo, eh? My sueldo. That's my sueldo. Yes, that's my sueldo. No, the Argentine for me have been very... I can't complain about it. No, no, no. And I've got a camp. It's in my name and my son now. And that has been property. We bought it property, and it was signed by Perón. They always say to me, what are you talking about, that you're not a Peronista, because you're... No, but you're not going away just yet, are you? For you won't be going off back for way down. Where are you going?
It's the middle of April now. I've crossed the island of Tierra del Fuego, and I've arrived on its southern shores. And it's clear that winter is approaching. The mountains all around me, both the Chilean ones to the south and the Argentine ones just to the north, are covered with a thick blanket of snow. I stayed last night in Ushuaia, the small Argentinian town on the shores of the Beagle Channel, and in the morning I awoke to find snow on the streets. Many of the people are unemployed. They wander up and down the foreshore, kicking at stones, not really knowing what to do with themselves. For travellers in South America, once you've reached Ushuaia, you've reached the end of the road. You can't go any further south, so Ushuaia is a traditional turning point, a point where, for most people, the outward journey ends and the journey home begins.